This is Jesus Shalom, a podcast about peace, spirituality, values, and activism from a Jesus perspective. I'm Tim Peebles.
And I'm Noel Mohs.
Each episode of Jesus Shalom explores what this radical and comprehensive peace of Jesus might look like in thought and life, conviction and practice. In our previous episodes, we've been exploring the broad contours of an overarching Shalom vision. In this episode, I ask Noel to give that expanded vision a bit of structure, a pattern for distinguishing some of the component elements of thinking about the vision and living into it. Before that, however, our conversation begins with some thoughts on the different ways we both approach reflecting on Scripture and our contemporary situation. So let's dive in. Hi, Noel.
Hi, Tim.
Noel, it's been really great to get back together once more to share and compare our insights and thoughts with each other, and of course, our listeners, exploring this great biblical vision of Shalom.
Tim, it certainly is. As you said in your opening remarks, this episode is going to begin to give the expansive and more encompassing vision of Shalom that we've been reflecting on together up until now, much more structure and shape, I think.
Okay.
Doing so in a way that I hope helps people to identify some of the central elements when they're thinking about the vision, and in that way, enabling us to discover for ourselves practical pathways for actually living Shalom day to day.
Well, this is exciting. However, before we get into some of that detail, I can't help reflecting, and I'm sure many of our regular listeners might have noticed this, that you and I each have fairly different approaches in how we get to our shared values and convictions. And I suspect our different approaches are going to become even more apparent as we get into the practical detail of understanding and applying Shalom.
Yes, Tim, you and I both share a passionate commitment to the Jesus-centered Shalom vision and the values that flow from that, that we hold in common. And we get these and think about them, however, in quite different ways. We each have our distinctive approaches and our different styles. Tim, how would you personally describe your difference in style and approach from mine, as you see it?
Well, let me begin with what we share. We both wish to be deeply biblical and widely contemporary. That is, we both want to be radically rooted in our scriptures and expansively inclusive towards our current world. These are the two poles that we both move back and forth between. More than that, we share, I think, a strong conviction that faith includes a kind of resonance between these two poles. Within that agreement, however, I sense that we both tend to start maybe at one of the poles or other, and then move, as it were, toward each other. These are maybe our contrasting patterns of thinking. You seem to begin with the biblical text and then move out from there to embrace the modern world. I, in contrast, tend to begin more in the modern world and move back into the biblical text. Does that seem broadly fair?
In broad terms, I think it's about right, Tim.
It's probably a bit too neat and tight.
Always is.
And in fact, there's always been a mix of biblical and contemporary impressions and insights as we go about our reflections. But there do seem to be these general and, I think, complementary tendencies. If I could put it a slightly different way, I experience myself as a kind of philosopher theologian, someone who thinks philosophically about our experience and our life in our contemporary context, and then seeks to make sense of these theologically by a deeper engagement with Scripture. My engagement with modern life and thought is in this way a kind of catalyst for revisiting Scripture, noticing and naming things I maybe hadn't seen before. Of course, I've spent my whole life in church reading those scriptures. So it's not like the scriptural themes and images and stories are absent from my modern experiences and reflections. But I do try to allow the contemporary context, our experiences, our patterns of life, our core stories and values, to allow those to have a kind of autonomy and integrity of their own before then taking them into an engagement with the scriptures.
Yes, Tim, I'd certainly affirm your engagement with our modern situation. As you say, I tend to begin at the other pole. I move towards, inwards towards meeting you from the opposite direction, from a deep biblical engagement out into a wider philosophical and contextual perspective. It's fascinating, isn't it, how our personal dynamics intertwined with character and temperament kind of work out in these areas. For me, the little phrase I coined some time ago, the ancient sacred, has always been core to my spiritual journey. As I find this interwoven into written texts, flowing through oral stories and wisdom, and of course revealed throughout creation herself. Then identifying as a Christian, the person of Jesus is always central, exampling and empowering the wide variety of biblical scripture, even reminding ourselves that we are first and foremost people of the spirit, not people of the book, something I really want to underline. Of course, I'm also passionate about today's culture, where I'm constantly searching for creative but authentic ways to share this ancient sacred as a contemporary street spirituality. It's the other phrase I would use probably to describe how I think and move, which everyone can connect with, not just as concepts, but also as real personal encounters. But Tim, it's clearly important and vital to both of us that the biblical source and the modern context, recognizing the importance of allowing each of these to have their own authenticity and integrity.
Absolutely. And hopefully that will be apparent to our listeners as we continue our conversations about Shalom. We'll return to, so shall we return to our main topic and see these differences at work?
Absolutely.
Great. Let's begin with a little history, though. You've been teaching and talking about Shalom for over 50 years now. And for a good chunk of that time, this occurred in the context of a program you created called Workshop. Uh-huh. Can you say a bit about that program? Why was it created? What did it do? Where is it now?
Certainly. Why was Workshop created? Well, on Easter Sunday, 1960, a while ago, a dramatic spiritual movement, later referred to as the Charismatic Movement, began in the USA, arriving in the UK shortly afterwards. And in those days, I found myself right at the very heart of this movement. While impacting mainstream churches across the UK quite dramatically at times, it also led to thousands of people deciding to leave their denominational churches and to meet up in small groups in their homes. And this became known as the house church movement. Well, as it is inevitably the case, it grew and developed and expanded. And by the mid to late 1970s, we find what I call the second phase of the house church movement. People began to move out of homes and into larger buildings, public buildings like schools or something like that, led by people with little or no theological training, and in many cases, very aware of that. Now, in the late 1970s, we joined just one such church in Middlesbrough in the northeast of England, in Teesside, which also became a hub church for about 50 similar churches scattered across the UK. Mm. And so local leaders began to sort of turn to us, have conversations with us, expressing their concerns that they were trying to do a job they had no training for. And the cry was wide, loud, and unanimous, please, can you help us? Mm-hmm. Now, that's quite a while ago, and there's things have changed a lot since then. And so there's several things that, you know, we need to recognize. What we need to first highlight is that almost all of these leaders had demanding day jobs. They also had families. Plus, they were trying to run a growing local church that was independent of the usual established traditional systems. Also, in the 1970s, in the UK, there were only two options if you wanted to do theological training. One was an absolute minimum of a year full time in a Bible college or a theological college. The other was the loneliness of long distance learning. And there was absolutely nothing else. And for people with full-time jobs, demands of a family life, running a local church, these were simply unsatisfactory solutions. So keeping it brief, I came up with the idea of running learning programs on weekends once a month, from September to July. So once a month, between September and July, every month, at venues scattered at different places across the UK, people could come and spend a weekend learning with others at location nearest to them. And this began in September 1983.
So what did you do in these weekends?
Well, remember, the first year of workshop had come into existence to meet a very particular need for a specific group of people. Nevertheless, even then, my clear intention was to present a radical Jesus Shalom-centered, as we would phrase it now, understanding of the Christian faith. Absolutely nobody else was doing anything like this at the time, and few even today. Mm-hmm. The material was amazingly, though I say it myself, all-embracing in its themes, and inclusive, very importantly, inclusive in its approach, theologically, practically, biblically, radically. It was applied theology with a real edge. You can check out our website, workshop.org.uk, where you can see all the material that we used to use and that we developed, set out under the themes that we worked with them with. Now they're available as a completely free resource to anybody who wishes to download them, and you're very welcome to do that. However, our learning environment and our ethos were equally key. From the very beginning, I insisted that workshop was a place where no question whatever was forbidden, and where even the most challenging subjects were definitely and deliberately to be explored. Early on, I came to describe workshop as a safe place where terrible things happen, for the very reason the fact that the subjects we engaged with, many people found disturbing, but in a good way. They found them liberating and exciting, not only to talk about, to discuss with other people who were learning together with us. By the second year of workshop, I'd realized that across the churches of the UK, mainstream and independent, more and more people were carrying important responsibility. This was the age when home groups and house groups and small groups, to give them their various names, became absolutely essential to any kind of church life. They gave local church their pattern. Everybody wanted a chance to think and to talk through and to learn about and apply their faith in ways that they could share with other people, both in church groups and beyond. People from all denominations and none began to come to workshop and found a real welcome there. So suddenly the whole landscape had changed, and what we'd started off to meet one particular need suddenly expanded to be meeting many needs. As time went on, increasing numbers of people found workshop as the only place and space where they could ask and explore quite a range of questions that they told me were literally forbidden to be asked in their local churches. I mean, this was astonishing and shocking, but it was the truth, and continued on for many years. Many people, some holding senior roles in teaching, in medicine, in industry, were coming to us because we were a unique place where they could ask the question, how does my faith play a role in both my work and in wider society today? Absolutely key question, but they found local church was not somewhere where they were able to raise those questions and engage with them. Others had vital theological questions that they were working with. But their church leaders, when they raised these questions with their church leaders, told them that they were probably not even Christians if they were asking some of these questions. And if they were Christians, church, local church, was certainly not the place where you were to discuss them. Mm. It's hard to believe, but that is the reality that we encountered.
Mm-hmm. So where is workshop now?
Tim, that's a good question. After running workshop for 30 years, we had seen something like 5,500 people had been part of the program. But even by then, it was slowly becoming clear that the way we had traditionally done workshop, if I can use that phrase, was becoming increasingly unsustainable. Mm. Our model of teaching had become copied, first of all, by other groups and churches. Now, that's a compliment,
yeah,
I suppose, but it meant that whereas we were the only show in town for a very long time, other people began to do similar things or trying to do them. And so that siphoned off people who might have come to us to go to the local church. And this is linked to the fact that our radical style of teaching meant that some church leaders wanted to set up their own courses where they could control, if I could use that word, the content, and therefore minimize many of the types of questions that we were encouraging people to ask. Now, this is disappointing, but they wanted to play it safe. We were rocking the boat, and they wanted to calm things down. So that also had an effect on the numbers of people who were coming to join us. Added to this, people's lives became increasingly busy with work and social demands. And so committing to a regular weekend or even a regular day was sometimes and often proving too much for them. And then with the advent of the internet, so many different ideas, so many different forums were available literally at the click of a mouse. And so in contrast, workshop became really increasingly difficult for people to access.
Well, that's, of course, one of the reasons we've set up this Jesus Shalom podcast, isn't it?
Exactly.
We've wanted to take this 30 plus years of experience of teaching and learning and the ethos of this and make it available to more people in a new online format.
You've got it absolutely right, Tim.
Mm. This podcast is brought to you by Anvil Trust, a charity that articulates, advocates, and advances Jesus Shalom in individual, interpersonal, social, political, and ecological life. To do this, Anvil shapes spiritually and theologically informed faith journeys through interpersonal accompaniment, facilitated conversations, and group presentations. Ways to connect with our Shalom work will be provided at the end of our show and in the show notes. For now, back to our conversation. Noel, I would imagine that like any good teaching and learning environment, you had some shorthand formulas for the complex ideas you were exploring.
Yes, Tim. Every good teacher has their own way of helping their learners to remember the things they're teaching. And in my case, I basically have two strategies. Temperamentally, I think with pictures. And so all through my teaching, I would try and use visual images and ideas that connected with what I was teaching in order to make them more memorable. I also encapsulate ideas by putting together phrases that are either catchy or surprising or unexpected. And in that way, I also help to make things memorable. I talk about becoming a meekness zealot or a childlike inquisitor, plus many, many more. Incidentally, the two I've just mentioned are titles to chapters in my book, Fingerprints of Fire, Footprints of Peace.
Do you have any of these formula for Shalom?
As it happens, I do. Among many things, I talk about being a Shalom activist. That was a very, very early one, which is out there in common parlance and in many cases no longer related to me. And I find that a great compliment. Also, I used to speak about Shalom shock, the challenge of encountering Shalom. I would speak about Shalom being explosive calm. All of these seem to connect with people and stick with them as they thought with me around the subject. I also speak about distilling the essence of Shalom in just four digits. They are 1, 3, 4, and 6.
Okay.
This is surprising because temperamentally I'm the kind of person numbers make me go blind, but there you are. However, in 2013, I did a 7-week book tour across North America with Fingerprints. And I knew that there would be many occasions when talking about the book, which of course has Shalom as its central focus, I'd be given short slots in which to present my vision of Shalom very briefly. And then I would leave and move on to somewhere else. And so I was prayerfully questioning, you know, how can I give people the true essence of Shalom in effectively a few minutes in a way that would remain memorable for them long after I'd left? And suddenly these four numbers popped into my thinking.
What are the four again?
1, 3, 4, and 6.
Okay, I think I got it. And I think I've seen a chart or a diagram of this somewhere, yeah?
Absolutely.
I'll make sure to find that included in, and to include it in the show notes. For now, let's hear what each of these numbers represents.
Sure. There is one overarching vision of Shalom. There are three absolute Shalom requirements. There are four essential Shalom relationships, and there are six active Shalom responses.
Okay, well, let's break that down a little bit, beginning with one Shalom vision. Of course, we've talked about that a fair bit over the last several episodes, but can you remind our listeners a bit about that singular vision?
Absolutely. Now, as we said in our very first podcast, shalom is the secret of the universe, literally embracing all things. It's the peace that changes absolutely everything in our thinking and our living. It's the place where contemplatives and activists meet. It's the source of engaged spirituality, radically creative, and it's the foundation of meaning and relationship. Shalom is best understood by words like whole, holistic, harmony, complete, intact, integrated. The idea of everything fitting together as a dynamic whole, developing and interacting in creative harmony. In a phrase, shalom is a single overarching vision of infinite, holistic, totally integrated, meaning-filled, harmonious, dynamic relationships.
I just heard an interview with Walter Brueggemann, the prolific Old Testament scholar and theologian, and in it he says that the biblical material presents a more excellent way of life in the midst of other more dominant ways of life. And your shalom vision would be a lovely way to characterize that more excellent way.
Yes, a more excellent way is a great phrase to associate with shalom. In fact, I'd probably push it a little further and call it the most excellent way. But you'd expect me to say that, wouldn't you?
I would. Well, you say that within the single shalom vision, there are three absolute shalom requirements. Why do you speak of requirements?
Okay, Tim, I speak of requirements because over many years, my study of the way in which the concept of shalom is used across the Hebrew scriptures and then reinforced in the New Testament, it seems clear to me that shalom is only ever present to the extent that these three realities are present. Okay. So much so that I refer to them as absolute requirements. Mm. In any given situation, one or two may be more present than another, but shalom is only ever present to the extent that the three of these realities are present. When I teach on this point, I describe the three absolute requirements together as being like a spiritual measuring tape that you can place alongside any life situation and actually see, and in fact measure, just how much shalom is present or absent in any given situation. Now, I found this a very powerful and also practical graphic image to work with.
Okay. So what are those three requirements then?
Okay, the three shalom requirements are physical well-being, justice in relationships, and thirdly, integrity in character. I'll just go over this again. Physical well-being, justice in relationship, integrity in character.
So we might call these the identifying features of shalom, the distinct marks of shalom, maybe even shalom signposts?
Yes, though I feel they are a great deal more than just identifying features or signposts, though they may well fulfill that role, of course. But it's only part of what they do. I would perhaps be more comfortable with calling them the three inescapable or essential hallmarks of shalom to amplify the other word that you use.
Well, these three requirements are then reflected, if I remember right, in the four relationships, right? These were mentioned a couple of episodes ago, but it'd be good for you to repeat them here.
Yes, Tim. The four essential relationships are shalom with God, shalom with and within yourself or myself, shalom with the rest of humanity, and shalom with creation.
There's a sort of inward, outward, and upward pattern to this, if we wanted to use some spatial metaphors.
Perhaps I find representing holistic ideas graphically always problematic mm-hmm. when working in a two-dimensional surface, but that's just how it goes. In the past, I put shalom at the center, with God being upward, with me being downward, with others being to the right, with creation being to the left. Now, this no longer really works for me, as every relationship has to be able to relate to every other relationship. So there is this profound holistic dimension that we really have to capture in how we think and talk about shalom relationships. Once again, the sphere that we've been using is a very helpful way of conveying the sense of spatial dynamic and flow between all the relationships. Nevertheless, the four essential relationships remain clear, spinning, and flowing, each in harmony together with all the others.
Nice. So we have one overarching shalom vision, three absolute shalom requirements, four essential shalom relationships, and then what?
Finally, we have six active shalom responses.
Okay, what are those six?
Okay, the six shalom responses are to seek shalom, to proclaim shalom, to make shalom, to live shalom, to pray shalom, and to expect shalom.
To seek, proclaim, make, live, pray, and expect.
That's right.
Why do you call these responses to shalom?
I refer to them as responses for several reasons. First, because when you look at the biblical texts, in which they're referred to, they're always presented as actions to which a response is required or expected. If you wish to engage in shalom in some way, so we have seeking shalom and pursuing it. We have blessed are the shalom makers, and so on. However, added to this in every case, the passages refer have an inner and an outer dimension to them as well. So I am to seek shalom within myself. You could probably call this a more contemplative dimension. While I'm also called to seek shalom right across society and the wider world, you'd probably call this an activist or mission dimension of shalom.
Nice, I like that.
I find all this very exciting, and of course it illustrates my earlier point that shalom is uniquely the place where contemplatives and activists meet.
So just to run through them again, we have one overarching shalom vision, three absolute shalom requirements, and those are physical well-being, relational justice, and integrity of character. Four essential shalom relationships, with God, with oneself, with others, and with creation, and six shalom responses, seeking, proclaiming, making, living, praying, and expecting. Noel, tell me, where did these numbers come from? How did you settle on them?
Well, they're very, very organic. They literally emerged clearly and simply out of the biblical text that I was studying within their context, just as somebody's DNA emerges from the analysis of a double helix in one of their body cells. It was as natural as that. I didn't kind of put them together and come up with the ideas. They just were they just naturally were there in front of me. However, Tim, I get the sense that you might be keen to have a longer conversation about these and perhaps even other numbers added in. which we'll have to do in our next Shalom conversation.
You're right, and that sounds like a good plan to me. A special thanks to Sarah Baker, who composed and recorded the original music you've heard throughout this episode. And thank you for listening to our conversation about Shalom. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please share this with your friends, review us in iTunes, and visit our website at jesus-shalom.org, where you can leave us questions, comments, and suggestions, and also sign up for our mailing list. If you'd like to connect with the wider work of Anvil Trust, you can visit us at anvil.org.uk and join our newsletter there. That's all for now. Deep Shalom to each of you.
Deep Shalom indeed.